This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pete Postlethwaite, was virtually unknown in America until the movie In the Name of the Father. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his moving and understated performance as Giuseppe Conlon, father of Jerry Conlon, who was unjustly accused of an IRA bombing. More recently, Postlethwaite played a mysterious and sinister figure in The Usual Suspects, and he co-starred in the production of Martin Chuzzlewit, recently shown on PBS. Now he's playing a scientist in The Lost World, one of the first of the summer blockbusters, and he's starring in the new British film Brassed Off. Brassed Off is set in Yorkshire in 1992, when a wave of mine closings is leaving men unemployed. The miners in Yorkshire have their own brass band, led by a retired miner named Danny, played by Postlethwaite. Music is his passion, and his goal is to win a national band competition. But when the miners are facing unemployment, they know they'll have no money to pay their band dues and no enthusiasm for playing. They try to tell Danny it's time to break up the band.
What is up with you lot?
Got our minds on other things, Danny.
Like what?
Blimey, Danny, you been on holiday or what?
How do you mean?
Well, it may have escaped your notice, like, but Pitt's under threat.
Aye. What's that got to do with us?
Oh, aye, you're right. Not a lot.
Now, listen to me, all of you. These are worrying times, I know that. Well, look what it says here, eh? 1881. Over 100 years this band's been going. No. 2 world wars, 3 disasters, 7 strikes, 1 bloody big depression, and band played on every flaming time.
I asked Pete Postlethwaite if he felt any connection to the miners in the film.
Yeah, I did. I did indeed. Yeah, I did. We've had, over the last 18 years, up until the last couple of weeks, when May the 1st happened in England, we've had a government which has systematically destroyed most of the beneficial arrangements that were tried to set up for the majority of the people in the country. I fought for the miners' right to strike and anybody else's right to strike when conditions were unbearable and intolerable, in the same way that I would campaign to get the release of the Guildford people in the name of the Father. They're all tied in. It's all how you believe about things, what you think about things, whether you have any compassion for people or whether you just think people should be factotums in order to make a buck.
The band that your character conducts in Brassed Off is a brass band.
Mm-hmm.
That plays things from the William Tell Overture to pop tunes. Are brass bands really popular in England?
They are. They are, specifically in the north of England, I think, more than in the south. Although it is a worldwide movement. I mean, the Grimethorpe Colliery Band do travel all around the world playing... Well, it's not so much traditional stuff now. I mean, we play, I think, in the opening thing we play in the film is the choral dance, I think, or the floral dance, as it's called. They would not necessarily choose to play that now. They play most extraordinary things like Rimsky-Korsakov and atonal stuff that goes on forever. I mean, it's unbelievable stuff. They're a very, very adventurous band. It is a tradition in England. It's a northern tradition, particularly, I think, and it's part of that wonderful tapestry that is the culture of that part of the world.
Did you have to learn to conduct for the film?
I did. Yes, I did, with a lot of help from 3 extraordinary conductors, because the band itself has 3 different conductors. Which is strange. They have a conductor who does rehearsals with them, who actually trains them. He's a very sergeant major kind of person, very strict and very fast and does all sorts of things. And then they have a conductor, a professional conductor, that comes in and conducts them when they do competition. And then they have another conductor who conducts them when they're doing concerts, which are more flamboyant and more showy. I mean, they even do Riverdance now, which is great. It's a wonderful version of Riverdance. So I was able to be alongside these 3 particular people and observe their particular styles. And just mucked in with the band, really, and found out how they thought and what they felt. And with their encouragement, it was possible eventually to stand up in front of them and pretend to lead them.
How would you describe the style of conducting that you do in the movie?
Dogmatic, authoritative.
Right.
Yeah. I spotted at one point it was interesting as an actor and not as a musician, because I don't read music, so I had to learn it all by heart, really, by ear, by just playing and playing and playing the tunes over and over again in my head, listening to that particular band play those particular pieces. And one particular night, I don't know why it was, I just suddenly realised that actually each piece of music was a story, a completely separate story to whatever else was. I mean, like, if it was the March of the Cobblers, that was a very specific tune to do with the March of the Cobblers, and it became a story as opposed to a piece of music to me. So as an actor, that was interesting and a nice way in, really, because I was able to relate to that and say, well, that's the story I'm telling at the moment. So I can tell that story and feel that kind of emotion.
My guest is Pete Postlethwaite, and he's starring in the new film Brassed Off. You're also going to be co-starring in Jurassic Park's sequel. Tell us about your character in The Lost World.
My character, Roland Tembo, well, he's the sort of the last of the philosopher hunters, really, the great white hunters who played by the book and tracked by the book and would never dream of using a jeep to go on safari. And he's, in fact, quite disillusioned when you first meet him in the film. I think he's had enough. He's shot everything there is to shoot in the world, really. He's not really interested until his faithful tracker, RJ, tracks him down in a bar in Mombasa and suggests that it might be interesting to bag a T-Rex. And that rather large carrot dangled in front of him means that he does succumb, and they do go onto the adventure, which takes them to the island of Nubar.
Were there anything standing in for the dinosaurs? Since I imagine the dinosaurs are added after the fact.
Well, no, not so much in this, because you're working with geniuses like Stan Winston, you know, who creates these extraordinary animatronics, these creatures, these models, which you have to keep pinching yourself every now and then to say, yes, they are models. They're extraordinary, but they're models. I mean, when we were actually pinning down the small T-Rex, the baby T-Rex, as a lure for the buck, the father of the baby T-Rex. Yeah, you do. I kept keeping a weather eye on its jaws, because it would turn round and look at you, and they're organising this from, you know, in between bushes and things like this, these extraordinary people who manipulate these things. And they are incredibly real. They are, you need no imagination to work with them. They're fantastic, unbelievable things. I think you will be surprised, I think.
You really made your mark in America with the movie In the Name of the Father, in which you played the father of a young man who's unjustly accused of an IRA bombing of a British pub. Mm-hmm. And the son's family is held as co-conspirators. So mm-hmm. you are imprisoned with your son, played by
yep.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great role. You know, you start off in the movie looking like a real spineless guy, you know, a father who'd never stand up for himself or for his son or for anybody. Someone who'd let people walk over him. But in the jail scenes, you show this surprising inner strength, and watching the dynamics change between the father and the son in jail are just sort of really fascinating, very subtle performance. Tell me your take on this character, what your profile of him was when you were figuring out how you should perform in the role.
Well, he was my dad, really. He was exactly my dad. Who died in 1988, who was northern working class Catholic. But there is a breed of these people that have this extraordinary inner strength. They appear to be spineless, they appear to be easy meat, but in fact when the pressure is on, they resort to their inner strength, this resilience that they have, which is based on their values and their beliefs and what they think. And my dad and Giuseppe were very similar, except Giuseppe was Northern Irish, whereas my father was Northern English. But they were exactly the same kind of background. And there's a whole breed of these kind of men and women. I mean, look at Sarah Conlon, what she went through. Unbelievable. And that's the kind of profile you get. You think, well, you've got to do justice to these people. You've got to, you know, make sure that at least when Sarah, for instance, would see the film, she would think, well, yes, that's all right. I'm proud of that. That's okay. It's very easy playing characters that don't exist, but when you play characters that did exist and whose relations still exist, I think you have to be doubly careful.
What do you think is the turning point in the movie when viewers start to see the strength that this character actually has?
I think when he... we were criticised and pulverised for actually making a pro-IRA movie, even before the film was finished, and it's patently obvious eventually that we're not. There's a point in the film where the actual bomber, the actual person who did do the bombing in the Guildford pub, is arrested and brought in from the Balcombe Street siege and brought into prison. And he actually did, and this is truthful, he actually did say to everybody in the prison, look, you've got the wrong people here. We did it. We'll tell you how we did it and what we did. Jerry, in the film, gets very involved with this man, and the father decides that he shouldn't be. And I think there's a point where he says, look, leave us alone. We don't want anything to do with that. We don't want anything to do with your violence. We don't want anything to do with that. And I think that's the turning point for Giuseppe, certainly, when Giuseppe suddenly realises that any kind of violence, any kind of attack on human dignity and human life is not going to change things, and he sticks to his guns and says to his son, go and play with your mates if you like, but don't bring that kind of thing to me. I think that was a big turning point, and it takes Jerry a little bit longer to spot that. I think he does spot it eventually in the torturing of the guard scene, where he suddenly realises that violence is not the best way to change things.
My guest is actor Pete Postlethwaite. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Pete Postlethwaite. Your character, Giuseppe, dies in the name of the father. What was it like for you to die in that role? Was that a really kind of moving moment for you?
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah, they're tough, those kind of scenes, I think. They're tough. They do take it out of you if you want to give it, if you're prepared to give it. It will take it out of you. So, I mean, it's the scene just prior to that, actually. The actual death scene wasn't too bad because that was, like, physical. The scene really prior to it in the cell with Dan, the wonderful Dan, playing Jerry, where he's putting Vic on my chest, I think. I think that was one of the hardest ones, and he just tells him every night he's tried to get out of that prison by going back in his head, in his memory, and walking down the Falls Road with his wife. And they are hard scenes. They do take it out of you, but, you know, you get it back eventually. You get it all back.
Now, you played a very different kind of character in an earlier movie called Distant Voices, Still Lives, and in this movie, you're an abusive father.
Horrendous.
And husband. And I know when I saw the movie, every time you appeared on screen, my whole body would tighten. I mean, it's like, uh-oh, here it comes again. So it's interesting how you were able to embody two such different kinds of fathers and husbands. And I wonder what the difference is in how you carried your own body, how you presented your own self physically in both roles, and In the Name of the Father and Distant Voices, Still Lives.
I never thought about it like that, really, but looking at it now, you're obviously right. Yeah, there was a difference. Strange, really, because maybe the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives was inherently weak, whether it was because of his lack of employment or his migraine or his drinking problem, I don't know, but he was inherently weak, whereas, in a way, Giuseppe Conlon was inherently strong and outwardly weak. I mean, he was ill, whereas the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives wasn't. And it's strange that I don't identify that father with my father, isn't it? But I don't. I mean, he wasn't like that.
Good.
yes. but that was actually a very autobiographical. That was a Terence Davis film, yeah?
Yes.
Directed by Terence Davis. It was completely autobiographical, I believe. Well, I know, because that's what he said. That's what he used to do. That's what it was like. And I don't know whether...
Would he critique your performance by saying, no, my father was more like this?
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. Oh, no, he would do that, yeah. I remember one particular scene where I think the daughter, we're in the cellar, cleaning up the cellar, I think, and the daughter asked for some money to go to a dance. And I think I hit her with a brush, with a yard brush. And I sort of whacked her a couple of times with the brush, and Terry said, no, he didn't do it like that. And he got hold of this brush, and he turned it the other way around where the end of the broom was, and we had this metal cage around the camera so that the brush wax would go into directly into the camera. And he bent this metal with this brush. I said, "Oh, Terry, come on, don't be silly. No father could do that to a nobody would do that to a child." He said, "No, that's what he did. I said, "No, do you mean that that's how it appeared to your sister as a child, and with this massive thing coming out. No, he said, that's how hard it hit. I said, well, he'd kill her. And he said, no, he didn't. He didn't kill her, and that's what he did. And you just think, blimey, where do you go from there? So I don't know. I mean, he had a lot to feel angry about his father about.
So tell me some more, if you can, about how, as an actor, you try to physically embody inner strength or inner weakness or outer strength or brutality.
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know how you do these things. I mean, it's a bit like asking a centipede which leg it sets off with. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know. A centipede just walks, doesn't it? You know, it just goes sometimes. I think you read the script and you read into what that character's about. You look at what the character does, what the character says, what other people say about him. I mean, what other people said about Giuseppe Comden was amazing. More people said things about him than he would ever say about himself. He was always, you know, he was an incredibly popular man around North Belfast and West Belfast, where he lived. You know, if anybody had trouble with their income tax return or something like that, they would go to Giuseppe, you know, and he would sort it out, you know. He never bought a drink in his life because wherever he went, you know, somebody said, do you have any pint for Giuseppe? So you get little incidences, you get little things from that. And also I was privileged enough to read through the kindness of Sarah the letters that he wrote to her from when he was inside the jail. And they're an extraordinary insight into that man's character. And that from that, I think you start to get to know how the man physically was. I mean, I think he was a taller man than me. I think he was thinner and a taller man than me. But there was, I think you use an image, don't you? You think, well, the man was ill, the man was sick. I mean, much sicker in a way than we played him in the film, because you wouldn't be able to play him quite as ill as he was. So I suppose all these little details and colours and shapes all start to come to you, and eventually you find a walk, really. You find how his feet function.
In The Usual Suspects, you played Kobayashi, the right-hand man of the real heavy,
mm-hmm.
in the movie. Did you understand the script when you read it?
No, not a word.
And did that bother you?
No, it didn't. It thrilled me. No, I read it. It was a very, very complex, rich, intricate, intriguing piece of writing, a wonderful bit of young writing. Chris McQuarrie, 24 years old, blimey, what a piece of writing. And I didn't understand it completely, no, I didn't, but it drew me, and it made me think, this has got to be done, it's got to be made. A wonderful, clever bit of writing. And wonderfully drawn characters, that's what I like, you know, like Kobayashi. The thing that drew me to Kobayashi was, there's one scene, where I think, where he's in a lift with the two heavies, and they get blown away completely. And it said in the script, Kobayashi deigns not to blink. And you think, well, that tells you a lot about that chap, doesn't it? Because he's got nothing to fear. A wonderful bit of writing. I remember meeting Brian Singer talking about it, the script, and he said, what are you going to play, Pete? What are we going to play? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you can play any of them. They're all Kaiser Soze. Which, indeed, they're not. There's only one Kaiser Soze.
Does that mean he didn't want you to know who Kaiser Soze really is?
I don't think any of us really knew, except Kevin Spacey. He had an idea. No, of course we did. We knew the script, and we knew it backwards by the time we were doing it. Had a great deal of fun making it. Fabulous. Fabulous piece of work.
There were a lot of really interesting actors in that movie, and probably a lot of quite a mix of acting styles.
Yeah. Different, yeah. From Baldwin to Gabriel Byrne to Kevin Spacey to myself to Parmentier. Charles Parmentier. I don't know. They always talk like that. I don't know. It's this man in New York. You got to blow your head out. You know? I think, blimey, is he going to do it like that, Benicio? Are you actually going to do it like that? And he said, yeah, I'm going to do it like that. And he did. And it's brilliant. You know, it's great because you don't half understand what he's saying, but you know exactly what he means. And I think that's brilliant. It reminds me of when my mum and dad came to see a Jacobean play we were doing in Manchester, the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester. Duchess of Malfi. It's a very complex, rich Jacobean play. And I said, with Helen Mirren and Bob Hoskins were in it. And they said, well, what do you think? Mum and Dad said, oh, I thought it was marvellous. My mum said, I thought it was marvellous. I said, well, did you understand it? She said, well, no, I didn't understand what you were saying, but I knew what you meant. And I think that's great. I think if you can do that, if you can tell a story like that, and if the story's are understood, then that's great.
Pete Postlethwaite stars in the new British film Brassed Off, and he plays a scientist in The Lost World. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Postlethwaite as a sinister and mysterious figure in The Usual Suspects.
Mr. Hockney, do stay. Mr. Keaton. Mr. Fenster, I recognize from his mug shots, as well as Mr. McManus. I can only assume that you are Mr. Kint, the gentleman who disposed of Saul Berg. My employer sends his gratitude, a most unexpected benefit. I am Mr. Kobayashi. I have been asked by my employer to bring a proposal to you, gentlemen.
What do you want?
My employer requires your services, gentlemen. One job, one day's work, very dangerous. He does not expect all of you to live, but those of you who do will have $91 million to divide between you in any way you see fit.
Who's your boss?
I work for Kaiser Soze.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pete Postlethwaite. He stars in the new British film Brassed Off and co-stars in the Jurassic Park sequel The Lost World. He also co-starred in The Name of the Father and The Usual Suspects. You're from a working-class family, I believe, in the north of England. Mm-hmm. How were you exposed to acting? Was it mostly through movies, or did you actually see a lot of theatre where you lived?
No, I didn't see a lot of theatre to start with. I suppose it was pictures, really. Saturday morning cinema and things like that. We used to go and see Tom Mix and Hopalong Cassidy and things like that. But I suppose in terms, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's something to do with the Catholic background. I mean, you know, being an altar boy, you know, being on that altar, you know, it's a bit like being on stage, you know. Maybe there's something in that. I don't know. And then at grammar school, I started to do a couple of plays. We did The Importance of Being Earnest, I remember, and A Man for All Seasons, and I quite enjoyed that, doing those kind of things. Then I went to college and read drama and PE, a strange mixture, physical education and drama. And drama eventually took over. It was at the time, the late 60s, when there was some extraordinary writing coming out of England. Plays by Pinter and Beckett and all these guys were all writing these extraordinary plays like Waiting for Godot and Look Back in Anger and stuff like that, all happening at the same time. And I thought, blimey, this is extraordinary stuff. So I really enjoyed all that. But then thought, well, you still can't go and be an actor. I mean, people from Warrington don't go and be actors, really. So I decided to carry on. I'd teach for a couple of years and then see what happened after that. And if I still fancied it after that, I'd go and do it.
So you taught physical education?
No, I taught in the first year, actually, when I left. I taught, really, it was hardly teaching. It was in what we call an approved school in England, which is for naughty kids, really. It's for children who find it very difficult to fit into the system and rebel against it, and that generally the schools can't cope with them, so they send them to approved schools, which they were then. So that was more like social work than teaching, even though I was, you know, employed as a teacher. And I did that for a year and then went to a girls' convent grammar school, would you believe, in Manchester, and taught 1,000 girls a week. Drama, that was. I was a member of the English department to start with, an English teacher on the staff. And the staff was massive. There's 77 on this staff. It's a big school. But I realised there wasn't a drama department, so I thought, well, I'll create a drama department and then I can be head of it, really. So that's what basically I did. So I taught drama there. But then even after that, after a year of that, I thought, still not really what I want to do. So I went back to school. I applied back to drama school and went back to basics at the Bristol Old Vic and left there in 1970. And now find myself in a studio in New York talking to you about it in 1997.
What did your
you're in Philadelphia.
What did your parents say when you left teaching? Did they think you were being unrealistic?
Yes, they did, yeah. Yeah, it took about 10 or 11 years before my mum stopped saying, well, eventually you'll get a proper job. And I think that basically came as well. These sound terrible stories against my mother, and they're not meant to be, but I think she realised, the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is a massive, wonderful company in England, or can be wonderful. They can also do some awful stuff now and again. But we opened a new theatre there, the Swan Theatre, and Queen Elizabeth, our queen, came to open it. And my mother, who's my queen, I suppose, came as well to watch it. And when she saw me being introduced to the Queen on the stage of the Royal Shakespeare Company, I think then she thought, well, no, yes, it's a serious job now. That's all right. That's perfectly all right for him to do. And I think, well, it was strange. Yeah, I think they did. They did think, oh, well, he'll grow out of that or whatever. It was a strange choice for somebody from my background.
Who were your acting heroes when you started acting, and did you end up working with any of them?
No, I didn't. I've never really had any heroes, to be quite honest. Other than maybe my dad and my mum, people like that, local heroes. I didn't, because I wasn't part of a tradition of film or theatre in a way. So I didn't really. I suppose in retrospect, and now, question it now, you can say, well, who did influence? I suppose I was influenced by people like Albert Finney in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and those kind of films that were coming out when he did Tom Jones, or Tom Courtney in Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and things like that. But I never actually did have any here. I never had any people to model myself on or base myself on anybody. I don't know. I've always ploughed a lonely furrow in that respect, really. Not consciously, not to say, well, I'm going to do it my way. I've never thought of that. David Bowie sang about no more heroes. I think I agree with him a bit.
Oh, I have one last question for you.
Go on.
Now, I understand when you were co-starring on Broadway in Cyrano de Bergerac, that Derek Jacobi, who played Cyrano, tossed his nose to you at the curtain call of the last performance.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, well, that must have been quite
absolutely
an honor.
True. I still have it in a little tin box at home. It's still there.
Did you know that was coming?
No, not really. No, I didn't know. You making sort of references to kind of, you know, catching the bouquet of the when the bride throws her bouquet and I'm the bridesmaid? No, that did happen. That did happen on the last night. Terrific last night in New York. Wonderful.
And so where's the nose being stored now?
It's in a little tin on the shelf and with all my other little memorabilia that are about, mainly from films as well as plays. But I even have the rosette that was on my right shoe from that show now. Lots of little things, keepsakes, lots of little memories. They're all good. They all remind.
What other memorabilia have you kept from your shows and movies?
Well, I have the baton from Breast Off. I have the belt that I wore as Roland Tembo. I have the plaque from the coffin of Giuseppe Conlon. I have the rosette I wore on my shoe for Cyrano de Bergerac, the nose-catching incident one. I have lots of things. There's always something. You always take a little bit back, I think, just to say, well, that's mine.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem.
Pete Postlethwaite stars in the new British film Brassed Off. You can also see him in The Lost World.